Thank you, Misha. As you notice from the presentation, I am no physicist. I'm not a physicist, I'm a biologist. But I have a keen interest in this networking between modeling, coming from physics, and what real life is. And the talk that I'm going to present today is really, is there a link between the two? So no, you're not going to see any equations on the blackboard. This is all going to be intuitive. And given now that the time of the day, I think this is best that this will stay this way. Okay, and so the title of my talk is really, I think you've heard from Misha Tzodik about delay activity in neurons in cortex, and he's brought up using all the fancy equations the idea that, you know, this delay activity can be a manifestation of attractor networks. And if you ask most biologists, they most of them are not even aware of these sorts of modeling, and they tend to think about cortical activity on a neuron by neuron basis. And really, I think the appeal of this approach is the fact that you're trying to look at coding based on populations that is robust to noise, and it has several other characteristics that I think Misha must have mentioned to you, and we can discuss it. So, in principle, these models are nice, but the question is, are these toy models that have been designed by starting from Hopfield and before that, or do they have anything to do with reality? Okay, and this is what we went and tried to do, and I'll just give you a glimpse of our findings about this. Okay, so is delay activity and attractor networks, are they linked in any way, and is delay activity a manifestation at the single cell level of attractor networks? Okay, so we start by, well, Misha has mentioned to you the delayed match to sample task, where basically, maybe we should turn off the lights here, it'll be easier to see. Better contrast would help. I think it's better now. Yeah. Thank you, Misha. Well, what the monkeys do is they see these images. Typically, we use these fractal images. And so here's one. And then there's a delay period where there's nothing on the screen. And they have to remember which image they've seen. And then another image comes up. And they have to say, is it same or different? And this is a task that has been designed, I don't know, something like 30 or 40 years ago. First person to actually note this delay activity was Joaquin Fuster from UCLA and Nikki from Japan. And so people have known about this delay activity for quite a while. And the idea was, well, since people have seen this delay activity after the image was seen, okay, so you'd see one image, and then you'd see this activity which persists although the image has been removed, people have thought that this has to do with working memory, the fact that you have to remember an image and keep it in memory until you see it again. And this is what people have written, although there weren't any sort of models in the sense of trying to actually formulate how is the memory kept during this delay period. Okay, and then came the experiment that I think Misha has mentioned to you. I've seen his figure before, that Miyashita's design, where he's done exactly this delayed match to sample experiment that I've mentioned, but he's presented the images in a fixed order. And what he's found was, well, first of all, he's found that you see this delay activity for images which were shown to the monkey many times over and over again. But you hardly see any of this delay activity for novel images. Okay, that's one issue. And the second thing was that you see this delay activity not just for random images, but for images that tend to be next to one another in a temporal sequence. Okay, so the images were shown in a fixed order, and if you'd get delay activity for a given image, let's say image number 54 in the sequence, you'd tend to have delay activity for this given cell, also for the neighboring images in the sequence, that is for image number 53 and 55. And you can see this here. Now, you've gone through this, Misha? Okay, so this was a sort of an interesting finding, because Miyashita suggested that, well, maybe this is related to long-term associative memory, in the sense that here you are, you have activity of these neurons, which is not just random, but it seems to be correlated with a sequence of events. And that's really where Misha Tzodik and Dani Amit came along, and they sort of took the attractor model, which was originally developed, I guess, by Hopfield, and sort of tried to apply this to this question. But before going into this issue of how do you actually get long-term associative memory, I want to elaborate a bit about the delay activity itself. So Misha mentioned this idea of an attractor dynamic. So how do we think about this? I mean, how, if you take an attractor network dynamic, how, if you were to look at it, you know, using nice graphics, no, and no equations, here's how you think about it, okay? And the idea is the following. You get these images which are presented in a fixed sequence. So image number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on and so forth. And each image, with time, for each image, you actually generate an attractor for a given image. Okay, so this takes time to, and many repetitions, not just time, but many repetitions to generate this attractor. And therefore, you would not see, if delay activity is related to the attractor, you do not expect to find delay activity to novel images. Okay, because it takes many repetitions to generate the attractor. But given that you've actually generated the attractor, what do you expect? What do you expect that when you present the image? So here we're looking at a sequence in time, okay? So this is the time where the image is presented. So it's image number 3. And because image number 3 is presented, visual neurons, which are generally activated by image number 3, would now be activated, okay? And the intuition is, of course, that because of the connections, the connections between images which respond to the same, sorry, between neurons that respond to the same image, you're going to get sustained activity after you remove the eliciting stimulus, in this case, image number 3. So that's what you see here. So this is the excitation, a scale of the excitation level, and this is of the inhibition level. And what you see is that as you present the image, you get excitation for neurons which respond to image number 3, and you get also global inhibition, or increase of global inhibition, which shuts down the other neurons. And then after you remove the stimulus, you still get residual activity in these neurons which respond to stimulus number 3, but no activity for the other images. Okay, so that's the general dynamics, and if you were to record from one neuron here, let's say from this neuron, you'd see that it has delay activity, although the stimulus has been removed. So that's the basic idea. Okay, now, one thing that was in Miyashita's finding was that Miyashita found that neurons tended to have delay activity to images which were nearby in the temporal sequence. And of course, Misha explained how this could have resulted if you were to think of attractor dynamics. But the real question is, well, how did this actually happen in the experiment? Okay? And if you think about it, there's one issue here that must be taken into account. And one strong prediction of this attractor model approach is that the delay activity should actually be elicited by a stimulus irrespective of the behavioral conditions. That is, if you give the right stimulus, because things are mechanistic, okay, then the neurons go through this dynamic and they settle into this stable state where some neurons are active and others are not, okay? And therefore, if you were to record the activity of the neurons, not just during the period between the sample stimulus and the test stimulus. So let's remember the notation. Sample stimulus is the first stimulus, and test stimulus is a second stimulus, and the monkeys are required to say, is the test the same or different than the sample? Okay? And most people have looked at this delay period called the interstimulus interval, or ISI, and saw that there was a delay activity at this period. Now, and a strong prediction of the attractor model would be that you're going to find the same sort of activity if you were to look at the activity after the test stimulus has been presented, given that the test stimulus is the right stimulus. Okay? So what we have done is actually record the activity not just between the sample and the test stimulus, but also across the inter-trial interval, that is, between trials. And we've used images that are shown here. You know, typically these are fractal images and Fourier descriptors. And this is just to give you some sort of the anatomy of what we're recording. I'll get back to the anatomy later, but just that you'll know this is an infratemporal cortex that we're recording. Okay, and the prediction is then that if you are to present, say, a given stimulus, which is the preferred stimulus of that specific cell, you're going to find that there's delay activity not only after the sample stimulus, but if the test stimulus is the same stimulus, you're going to see this activity also across the intertrial interval, okay? Because this is mechanistic. Given that you've given the right stimulus, you're going to get to the same stable state. And this is exactly what we've tested. And here are some results. So this is just to give you a flavor of what results look like when you're recording neuronal activity. So here are three different stimuli that we've used. And this is now the activity during the sample stimulus. So S is the sample stimulus. And here the arrow is the time when the fixation point comes up. So the monkeys have to press a lever, fixate a fixation point, then the stimulus comes on. And what you see is here's the raster display. It shows each blip here is a spike of the neuron. And you see that first of all, the neuron is selective. It fires more when a certain stimulus is shown, say stimulus number 14, then stimulus number 24, hardly fires at all to stimulus number 8. See, there's hardly any spikes here. Okay. Point number two is that it's not only stimulus selective, but it has delay activity for a given stimulus, not for others. Now, it's important to note that the delay activity would be stimulus selective. Is that clear why? Well, if it wasn't stimulus selective, it might be a manifestation of something else than memory. It could be expectation of reward, it could be arousal effects, things like that. Okay, so if you have to have stimulus selective activity in order for this activity to be related to a memory process. When is the stimulus rewarded? Yeah. So the monkey would see one stimulus, just like you've seen one stimulus, then there would be a delay period, then there'd be a second stimulus, and then the monkey would have to release the lever or keep the lever, depending if it was same or different. And if he answered correctly, he'd get rewarded.
Okay, but afterwards, it's not the representation after conditioning learning, but just the test presentation.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
You are interested in looking for differences between before and after learning, but before learning and then rewarding.
No. So the monkey's fully, he can perform the task without any flaws. Okay, so the monkey's learned already the task. Okay.
So it's just a representation of the stimulus?
And it's just a representation of certain stimuli which he's learned. Okay, so we keep showing the same stimuli over and over again, and look at the responses. We record from a given cell in infratemporal cortex, and we look at the responses of the cell to the different images. Okay, and we see that the cell is selective; it fires to a specific image, not to others, or little to others. And not only that, but it has delay activity, which is stimulus specific. So you see this. This is also typical. The delay activity is much lower than the evoked visual activity. Okay, so that's another problem that the theorists have to solve, and that is, how do you maintain the attractor without actually bouncing out of the attractor if the firing rates are so low? And you might have heard something about this, and this is a point to discuss later. Yes?
So you're saying that the other images that don't have this activity are stored somewhere else?
No, I'm saying that this is a specific cell. This cell is selective to these images. If you were to record from another cell, it would fire to this image and not to this one. Okay? Okay, no, so all I'm saying is that you're right. You know, if you were to record from other cells in the same neighborhood, you'd find that other cells are selective to other stimuli. Okay, so I would say that as a module, they represent all the images. Okay, but different cells are activated for different images. There was a question there? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
If in addition to learns to patterns, you throw in like new stimuli.
Yeah. How well do the monkeys perform the task?
Yeah.
Okay. Good point. That's a point which I left for the end. But now that you've mentioned it, one thing which we'd have to deal with is the fact that the monkeys can generalize. Once they learn this delayed match to sample idea, they can generalize it and apply it to any stimulus, even to novel ones. Okay. Now, originally in Miyashida's data, he did not see any activity for the novel images. Okay. And this is also consistent with the attractor approach. You do not expect delay activity because you have to have many repetitions to generate the attractor. Okay. So you have here a dissociation between the monkey's ability to perform the task while there's no delay activity in IT. Okay. So this is a problem that we'd have to deal with later. Let's keep it in mind. Okay, going back to the slide that I'm showing you here, the point that I've wanted to make was that you see that there's delay activity for a specific stimulus during the sample, or after the sample stimulus has been shown, that is in the classical delay period. But if you are to sort the data, which no one bothered to do before, sort the data and look at the activity of the neuron to different images during the test period and after the test period, that is after T here, okay? So in order to do that, you have to resort the data, right? Because note that if you are to present a trial where the sample and the test are the same, then of course you don't have to resort the data. But in cases where the sample and the test are different, then of course you have to take the data that's presented here and resort it, okay? Because this and this would not correspond to one another. Are you with me? Okay. That's a small point, but an important one. So you have to go through, you have to do this, okay? And then if you actually look at this, at the data this way, what you find is that there's, first of all, as expected, visual selectivity during the test period just as much as during the sample presentation. That's no surprise. But you find also that there's a delay activity. Okay, so this is the period right after the test stimulus has been shown, and this is the period before the next sample stimulus is shown. And you can see that there's a delay activity which is continuing across trials. Okay, so there's a delay activity which is continuing across trials, and you can see this, that there's hardly any delay activity here, while there's some delay activity here. Now, notably, it's not dramatic. As I said, the delay activity in IT cortex is of the order of 10 spikes per second, 15 spikes per second at most. Okay, but it is a prediction of the attractor network approach, because if you present the right stimulus, you're supposed to go to the fixed point or the attractor fixed point for that specific stimulus, irrespective of what the monkey is supposed to do. Okay, so that's an important finding. And not only that, but it also is a beginning of an explanation of how do you get these correlations that Miyashita found and Misha mentioned. What do I mean by that? Okay, let's summarize here. So you have stimulus-specific sustained activity, and it's across trials as well as with hint trials. Okay? And just this is just, you know, we're not going to pay too much attention to this, but this is just to show you that the effects that I've shown you here are consistent across the whole population of cells. Yeah. Oh, okay. Good point. I think actually this is a better graph to show you. The delay activity here lasted for a few seconds, just because this was the delay interval that we kept the monkey. If you increase the delay interval, it's a problem because the monkeys are not very happy about this if they have to wait long enough before they can get rewarded. Okay? Now, Miyashita found that this delay activity can persist for 16 seconds. We never tried it, but the truth is that it actually decays. Usually it decays during the delay interval. And you can see this here. So this is the ISI, interstimulus interval. That's between the sample and test. Okay, so this is, what you see here is the activity for the best eliciting stimulus versus the worst eliciting stimulus. So you see there's a difference, okay? And if you look right after the test stimulus has been shown, you see that this difference is actually enhanced. But it's decaying, okay? And the difference here is much smaller, okay? So towards the end of the interval, it's smaller than it is in the beginning, which is another problem, to be frank, you know, because it's non-stationary. This is also seen here on a cell-by-cell basis. So each point here corresponds to a specific cell, and it shows you what's the activity like during the classical delay interval. That's the beginning, and that's the end of the delay interval, and that's in the intertrial interval. Okay, so you see that there's this decay that you've noted basically in every case. Okay. But still, looking at the positive side of things, you still see that there's a difference which is retained across this interval. Okay, so the way we think about it, and this is just a sort of a pictorial representation of what you've heard from Misha, is that initially, the cells have no delay activity. There's only visual responses. So this is sort of a way to depict this. There's these populations of cells which are firing when stimulus number one is shown, and these are for stimulus number two, and so on and so forth. And so if you were to have an electrode and record from a cell which responds to stimulus number two, then it would start firing whenever you present the right stimulus, that is stimulus number two here, okay? And it would fire whether it's a sample stimulus or a test stimulus, okay? And if you were to have another electrode and record from this cell here, it would fire for stimulus number three, okay? Now, so all these cells would fire together when stimulus number two is shown. And, you know, just with Hebbian learning, what you're going to get is amplifications of or potentiation of the synapses between them. And in the next stage, what you're going to get is sustained activity. That is, you're going to get activity for which persists across the delay interval for a given image. Okay, now, the next stage of the evolution is that because you have this sustained activity following stimulus number two, which persists until stimulus number three is shown. Okay, so here's what you see here is sort of the progression of the images shown in the Miyashita experiments. So the monkey's seen stimulus number two, and in half the cases, the test stimulus was same as the sample stimulus. So it was again stimulus number two, and then stimulus number three comes up, right? And what you see in terms of the neurons is that there's a sustained activity at this stage, a sustained activity for a neuron which is selective to stimulus number two, which is in a window of opportunity where there's also visually evoked activity for the next stimulus, that is stimulus number three. Okay, so because of this window of opportunity, you can get Hebbian strengthening of synapses between population activated by stimulus number two and the population activated by stimulus number three. And this leads to the phenomena that Misha has described, where you get sustained activity not only for a specific stimulus, but also to its neighboring images, okay? And this is what Miyashita has found. So what you get, and we tend to think about it as association formation. Now you get similar representations for images which are shown sequentially in time. Okay, so here you are, and you've generated an association between an image and an image which is next to it in time.
But then if you send now number three, then you should also see an activity for the cells which responds to two, right? I mean, for example, you have done all three is important for the cell.
Yes.
And then you give three and you observe two. Then the subset two over there. Then you should also see these.
Oh, so it's symmetric. It's absolutely symmetric. As Mitchell has shown, these correlations are symmetric. Okay, it's in both ways in time.
But do you see?
Yes. This is what Miyashi has found. Okay, this is exactly the. Let's go back and see if I can find you this thing right here. You see these? So what you see here is the delay activity for different images going from 0 to 100 or 1 to 100, and you see that these towers are symmetric. There's no asymmetry in these towers as much as you can see here. Okay. Oops. Let's go on. Okay, so this is just another way to show the same thing. Okay, here you are and you get this activity. You're shown, say, stimulus number two, so you get activity for neurons which are activated by the attractor, which are part of the attractor for stimulus number two, and they're firing this sustained activity during the delay interval, and then there's these cells which are activated by stimulus number three, okay, C and D, and you have this window of opportunity for Hebbian strengthening between the two to generate these associations. Okay. Great. Now, I want to give you, I've talked up to now and referred only to infratemporal cortex. Delay activity has been found not only in infratemporal cortex, but in many, many areas in the cortex. And I want to just give you some overview of this for the next 10 minutes or so, and I'll be finished, okay? Because you guys are finished already, so I won't take much more of your time. Yes? Sorry? Yeah. They're identical? No. This was a model. What I've shown you before was a model. Yeah. No, I was saying if you were to record, this is all a model, okay? If that wasn't clear, let's get it right. This is a model. No way you'd see something like this in reality, okay? Okay? Now, I've concentrated up to now only on infratemporal cortex, which is just to focus you. So this is a lateral view of your brain, so you're looking at the monkey brain. This is the back of the monkey brain. This is where the primary visual areas are, and this is the front, and this is infratemporal, the temporal lobe, which is a side lobe of the brain. And when you actually look at the macaque brain, there's of course a lot of functions or a lot of factors that would affect the cells respond. So if you look at V1, it's true that the cells are just visual. Okay, that they what matters is what is the visual stimulus shown. If you're looking already at the anterior IT, okay. So as I've shown you, there's a component of memory as well, and not just a visual component. And if you're looking at prefrontal cortex, which is the next area which I'd like to center our focus on, you find that it's not only visual and memory, but also motor effects and reward effects, which affect the activity of the neurons in these areas. And of course, there's some motor areas, which I'm not going to deal with here. And what I'd like to mention about the prefrontal cortex is the following. And this is an experiment that was not done by our lab, but by Earl Miller's lab from by Earl Miller's lab in at the time it was at the NIH with Bob Desimone, and it refers to the question that I was asked before. Well, okay, so I've shown you that cells in infratemporal cortex have this delay activity. And this delay activity seems to be manifesting the last stimulus seen. That's an important fact. And you don't see any delay activity for novel images, while the monkeys are able to perform the task without any problem, even if you use novel images. Okay, so they can generalize the task. So clearly, this delay activity is not related to the task. It's not a, necessary and sufficient condition for performing the task. But somehow the monkeys do perform the task. So can we find areas where you find this delay activity across intervening stimuli, for one thing, and for novel images? Well, the answer is yes. And where we find this is in prefrontal cortex. So again, this is just to orient you. Prefrontal cortex is right here, okay? So relatively in the front part of the brain. And Errol Miller has designed the following task. What he's done is, instead of presenting just one sample image and then showing a test image, which would be the same or different, he's shown a sample image, okay, like the butterfly in here, and then there'd be what you call intervening images, okay? So there'd be 1 to 4 intervening images until the same image was shown again. And the monkey's task was basically to detect the repeat of the sample image and release the lever when this sample image is repeated. And what L. Miller has found basically was that unlike infratemporal cortex, you find in prefrontal cortex that the delay activity for a specific sample image is retained across intervening images. Okay, so it's a way, basically, if you want, it can hold the representation of the sample image as requested from the monkey across the intervening images. And that's what you see here. Effects are very small. I'm not sure if this is very clear, but okay, so these are the periods where the images are shown. That's in gray. So the first one is a sample image, say the butterfly, and then you see different images, intervening ones, so non-match ones. Finally, the match one comes up. And what you look here is, during this period, is the delay period activity. Okay, so no wonder that you get more activity for the best image than the worst image during the first delay period. But it is interesting that you find that, unlike in infratemporal cortex, that this delay period activity is maintained, although an intervening image has been shown now. Okay, so say you've shown the butterfly, now you show the umbrella, and although you've shown the umbrella, this stimulus-specific delay activity for the butterfly is maintained, although the umbrella has been shown. And this is very unlike what you find in infratemporal cortex. Okay, so this is an interesting finding because the delay activity can be bridged across intervening stimuli.
So you said the first one was the umbrella matching the lion. So the lion would also have a persist. If you look at the lion cell, would it also have had delayed activity?
Yeah, for
it was not being asked for. Now, you know, the first picture, the monkey is asked to remember. Whereas the second one is not.
Right. Good.
So does he still show delayed activity or?
Right. So I've asked him this question. I didn't get quite a good answer. So I'll put it this way. Say that you present a sample image which is the wrong image. Okay? So let's say that the cell is selective. It fires for an umbrella. Okay? Now, say that the first image was a lion. So you don't get any delay activity. And then you present the umbrella as an intervening stimulus. Do you find delay activity for the umbrella? Although the monkey is not supposed to remember the umbrella. He's supposed to remember the lion, if I got that right. Okay? Let's go through an example that will be helpful. Because I'm not sure. Tell you the truth, I'm not sure if I got that right. Okay, so say that the specific cell is selective and it fires for a lion. It does not fire for the butterfly. So you present the butterfly, no delay activity, right? And then the lion comes up, but it's an intervening stimulus. Does it actually lead to enhanced delay activity? And
in the finger, you see not.
Well, the figure, yeah. No, that's a good point, but the figure is an average across all images. Okay? So you can't understand from here, is that the case or not?
And I, just the best and worst.
Yeah, that's the best and worst sample stimulus. So it refers to what the sample stimulus
so
was.
Look at the best line.
Yes.
Best line is the example where the first sample stimulus is not leading to any
relative. Right? Yeah.
And then, despite of the fact that you have intervening stimuli, some of them may be good, you still go back to zero relative.
Absolutely. But if most of the images are bad, then you're not going to see the effect because of averaging, okay? So that's the point. And truth is, I don't think he's actually analyzed the data to check this. But if this is sort of a sort of an active process where you're trying to remember the first image, then you should not expect delay activity, okay? Okay, so this is the picture, and I'd like to elaborate on some other tests that can be made in order to see if really the attractive picture corresponds to what we see from single neurons. Yeah.
Do you think that this has something to do with the fact that the
I don't think you can't tell between the two,
yeah,
as it is. Well, one thing that we're trying to do is ask the monkeys to remember a number of elements, not just the first one, okay? And then you'd be able to differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
If it's strong enough, it's stable enough, then the yeah, but usually we don't think about it this way, right? Usually they're not very stable, right? The problem is actually to stabilize them, rather than if you give a different input, you usually are out of the attractor, right? That's usually the way we think about it. Yeah. Oh, it usually does respond. Oh, so now you're saying, okay, what's the noise in the system? Okay, and, okay. So he's never analyzed this. We've looked at this, and with respect to the fact that if you notice, first of all, what he shows here is average, and it's an average not only across different trials but also across different cells. Okay, but it's a good question. I mean, there's also a prediction. So I was about to get to this point, okay? And that is the predictions of how do you go about checking if this attractor sort of attractor picture has anything to do with life. So one expectation is really that if you were to look at on trial by trial basis on the activity of the cells, you expect that if you see that suddenly for some reason the delay activity, let's see if I can find this example for you. Maybe this one. One more. Yeah. Okay, let's try to look at it more closely. Okay. Now, I don't think you can see this very clearly here, but if there's a trial where for some reason there's no delay activity, okay, you expect that if the delay activity is a prerequisite for performing the task, okay, in prefrontal cortex, then in that case the monkeys would make mistakes. Right? While if the delay activity is persistent across the whole delay period, then the likelihood of a mistake is smaller. Okay? It's not a one-to-one relationship, of course, because there may be other factors which affect behavior. But
you're assuming that the whole pattern
relies on one neuron, then. No. But the thing is that this one neuron is not is. Okay. So I'm assuming that this neuron is a good representative of the behavior of the network.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you don't see a delay activity, then the network has not settled into the attractor state. Has not settled into a stable state. Or it jumped out of the stable state at some point. Okay?
So as far as your understanding of the system is, it doesn't happen that the neurons just pop in and out of an attractor that, say, has 1,000 neurons in it, and say, at any stage, 900 will be finalized?
Oh, well, it's hard to tell. Truth is, it's hard to tell. But I think that when you're, I mean, if you look closely at the behavior here, you see that these neurons fire quite erratically, okay? So if you were to look at one neuron, you see that for a relatively long period, it may not fire at all, okay? So if you're looking at the instantaneous firing rate, it might change variably across the delay period, okay? So, but I don't really have an answer to your question, to tell the truth. Okay, but this is one prediction. Another prediction is, refers to what David Kleinfeld talked about, and that is perturbations, okay? So if you think of this, of an attractor, one serious requirement that an attractor has, should obey, is that there's a basin of attraction. Meaning that if you take the image and instead of showing the exact image, you perturb it, okay, you degrade it in some ways, as long as you don't degrade it too much, okay, you're still in the basin of attraction. You should get to the same stable point, okay? So that's a strong prediction, and we've tried this, okay? I'm not going to show you the results, but I'll describe them if we can have the lines. Let's close this. Can we turn? Oh, I guess we can put just the lid on top of this. Thank you. Misha, do you know which one is it? Okay, it's the only one I didn't try. So the idea is simple, okay? So this is degradation level. See? You take an image and you start degrading it, okay? And this is the, let's look first of all at the visual response. This would be spikes per second. And you expect that if you degrade the image, well, basically you're going to get some kind of a drop in the visual response as you degrade the image. Okay. Now, if you were to record the delay activity of the cell, you expect that although there's a degradation in the visual response, in terms of the delay activity, you're going to have, as long as the degradation level, okay, is not at some critical level, then you're going to have delay activity, okay? So what you're going to see is something which looks like this, right? So you're going to flip from one state to another, okay? Before some critical level of degradation, okay, it would be immune to changes in the visual response, okay? Because you're going to still be in the basin of attraction. If you cross this threshold, then you never get to the attractor, the fixed point, okay? And what you expect is to go to, this will be just the spontaneous rate. So this is true delay activity. While if you cross this threshold, you're gonna hit just the spontaneous rate of the cell. And now, the dream experiment would be to record simultaneously from a few neurons which belong to the same attractor, okay? And now you'd expect that this jump would occur at exactly the same point in all neurons, right? Because they belong to the same attractor, okay? Now, we haven't been able to do this, but we have been able to do this in some example neurons, okay? And we did find this behavior in some example neurons, okay? But I cannot say that this was the characteristic behavior of all neurons in infratemporal cortex. I wish I could say this, but I can't say this. So I would say that, you know, to summarize, the evidence that that actually the brain uses this attractor network kind of a computation for associative memory is somewhat unclear. at the present point. Okay, I think there's pros and there's some cons, and it deserves much more consideration than has been up to now, because I said most people are sort of against it to start with. Okay, and as I said again, there hasn't been really strong evidence for the existence of this sort of attractor network. But I'd say that the jury's still out. Okay, it's a nice idea to start with. I mean, I the reason why I spend my time with this is because I think I can't think of a better alternative for associative memory than the attractor approach. Okay, the fact that we may have not been in the right area, or we still have to accommodate for a lot of things for biological plausibility, is absolutely right. But I think that, unfortunately, we don't have better alternatives at this point. Okay, maybe just because we're feeble-minded. So if you guys have any better ideas, we'd love to hear them. And, you know, now I just if you have any questions and you want to open things for discussion, I think it's probably the right time. And if you're too tired, I can understand that as well.
Few,
then.
A few patterns, but of course, somebody already mentioned the hop the whole social network idea is that the information is spread around the network.
Right.
And so you don't have just a grandmother neuron and a grandfather neuron, but everybody sort of
right.
Space. And this, to me, it seemed like it was counter to that. And you want to comment on
that? It's just a matter of fractions. So let's imagine
right.
that you
right.
have a network of 10,000 neurons, 100 by 100.
Yeah.
And every 10,000 neurons, let's say every pattern activates
1%.
Let's say a few percent of this, a few hundreds of neurons. But this sort of, so let's say this is a activation for pattern number one. This could be still distributed. And then if you come in the pattern number two, you don't have any color structure. So it would activate another few percent of the cells, but they could overlap. So if you look now at any particular neuron, it could be activated by again a few percent of the pattern. So if you have many patterns, then you would have every neuron participating in coding for a few patterns out of the whole cell. It would still be distributed. It would be sparse, but still distributed. It would not be one grandmother cell for each of the patterns.
Actually, the whole idea is that the overlap is a manifestation of the association between the images, right? So
yeah,
to start,
I mean, I guess you're trying to look for features of in the experiment that really cry out for the associative network.
Right.
And so you're trying to look for features of the associative network. This one does, and what you know, this one didn't.
I say that you wouldn't deal with the parts. You would have patterns which would be more like widespread. You are. Surprised that there is a sparse network.
No,
it's not.
If you've seen the other kind of behavior, that would be more stronger evidence of the network. That's about all I'm saying. You could explain it.
But there are advantages of sparse communication, like in the field.
Well, and the wasted bandwidth, too.
Wasted what?
Wasted capacity or wasted bandwidth.
There's this whole issue of how do you maintain, you know, the attractor network if you through intervening stimuli. Okay, so you have to remember, say that you have this image which you have to remember, the umbrella, and then there's these intervening stimuli. How do you manage to keep the network in a given state, although the input, the outside input, is actually changing, okay? And then
I think you have a tougher problem with what you do if you want to remember many presented with a list of thoughts, let's say, that I asked which one appears in the list or not, and they can do this. And even if I'm candle, there are effects like dragging, which so that they actually keep trace of all of the lists, although they were very long and for a long time. Now, can you really imagine that all of these attractors are simultaneous in the middle and it's hard? So,
apparently,
there are some other mechanisms of the wandering thing.
Right.
Thing rather than just keeping the activity pattern there for the whole time.
Right.
Maybe some fast synaptic plasticity or some other kinds of modifications, right, which are not necessarily manifested by carrying the whole pattern for the whole time.
Right.
There could be something wrong, I mean, just from an experimental point of view, that if you always show Robert's hand the same list, it could be that the monkey is learning the list as a pattern, as a forward pattern.
Right.
But if you remove, or if you try to just take off one of these patterns and substitute it for another, it could be that what the monkey is actually thinking of is that the whole pattern was changed instead of single triads. So that it's not that he thinks as the whole sequence as a concept.
Oh, okay.
So it's like a meta pattern.
Okay, so one comment here. I mean, you're absolutely right. I'm not sure if this is what you meant, but you're absolutely right about one thing that I failed to mention. I don't know if Misha mentioned this, and that is that Miyashita, in the original experiment which I described, he's used these patterns which he's shown over and over again in a fixed order. Wait. But when he's actually recorded the neurons, what he did was present the images in a random order. And why is that? Because otherwise you'd get these. I've shown you that this delay, there's a delay activity for distinct images which are, you know, sequential in time. Well, maybe that could be related to just changes in the arousal or attention of the animal. Well, but if you actually randomize the presentation of the images during the recording, then that's not a concern. Okay, so that's been taken care of. And we've done the same thing, yeah.
Two questions. One is, has anybody done a control experiment just to make sure that the system activity is the only thing responsible for the recall? And that is, say, to show an image, and then a few hours later to show the monkey the same image again and see whether he still remembers it.
Okay, so clearly the persistent activity in IT is not necessary or sufficient for performing the task, okay? Because you see that the monkey can perform the task for novel images, although there's no persistent activity in infratemporal cortex, okay?
But that's, okay, slightly different control. But here I'm asking, could he have memory for the same image without persistent activity, or the time
Well, I would say the following. I would say, but Misha, I'd like to hear your comment about this. I would say that what you get is basically an embedding of a specific image through the synaptic changes, okay? So that when you see the image, okay, you can retrieve it. But there's a long-term element and there's a short-term element. The long-term element is in the sense that through repeated presentations of the images, you get this changes in the synaptic structure, so that you actually can retain the image once you see it. But you have to see the image once again. Okay.
You can see the image once and then 5 hours later see it again.
Yeah, but I don't. Yes, but I don't expect that 5 hours later you're going to have the same persistent activity given from the initial image. What I expect is that the synaptic structure has been changed, if you've shown it enough time, so that when you see it once again, you'd be able to retrieve it immediately.
So is it so clear that this cannot last for 5 hours? This would sound good, but if it can last for 16 seconds, why couldn't it last for 5 hours?
Right, well, not...
Well,
you've just said, you mentioned pigeons, and you know, it's clear that that animals can remember much more images than you can actually imagine, okay? And it's hard to envision that you have all these attractors working at the same time, and being maintained at the same time. So I think that's very unlikely that this is the way actually the images are retained. Okay. For long, in the long term, yeah.
There's a number that you've just brought it up, and it's been coming up a lot, and that's this 10,000 or slightly more than 10,000. It comes up all over, especially in this context of the fact network. And the justification that I've sort of heard for it is roughly the number of signups is so dense connections, and then there's sparser connections to other blocks of roughly the same size. Where does that find it going, and where does it end? What extent is this
one of the robots? Is it true that all these neurons were found in just 1 millimeter square? Because 10,000 neurons are capable of about 1 millimeter square of the cortex. So is it true that all the neurons with the delayed activities are found in the small area?
No, I don't think so. No, no. I mean, that's also a strong prediction, and it says that what you have in order to maintain an attractor state or an attractor is, of course, to have strong connectivity between the neurons, right? So the idea stems from that. You want them to be relatively nearby because the connections decrease exponentially with the distance between neurons. Okay.
Is there any physiological evidence for these blocks?
Well, let's put it this way. It's clear that in infratemporal cortex, there's a division, and there's these, as Misha said, there's these columns where cells are basically sort of, functional for one specific image, one type of image, and not for another. Okay, so there's this columnar structure. It's not clear that this columnar structure is also seen when you're looking at delay activity. Okay, so it's open, I think. It's an open question.
Yeah, if it were true that, for example, the same type of images, you would typically see this delay neuron in the
body.
Delay neurons in the body of the cortex, you would say this is the typical size of the optimal partial.
That's what you'd want to see, right?
My recollection was that, I don't know if it was written in the paper or somehow, and it got out. Actually, these neurons were found mostly in the very small area.
There's some indication to that, and there's more to what we'd like to believe. Okay? But there's some indication to that. Yeah.
Is there any difference in learning if you're showing black and white images as compared to colored images?
I don't know. We've never tried this. We've always used these color images. But
so maybe I have a little bit different angle of view.
Sure.
From I remember well Yamashita did this experiments with the picture of fractals generated by one sort, dynamical system.
Right.
Okay. And I had personally a very interesting experience. You know, we tried to teach neural nets on chaotic signal.
Right.
Chaotic signal was generated by, you know, some dynamical system. And we were surprised that such nets learn dynamics first. Okay? So, you know, you can play game with the number of points of time series and so, and it's really it's surprising that it was also find this by other people, I mean, some in the US maybe, people, I don't know, but I think it seems that the neural nets, you know, learns for something generated by some dynamics, first is dynamics, you know, if you know, if you know, I can't explain it, but it's true.
No, I'm not sure what the point is. And
the point
that's what I'm saying.
If you teach such networks, you know, only on every, I don't know, 100th point from the series, appropriate sampling, the net will learn it in much better, I mean, more appropriate way for sending a good learning of really. I mean, time series generated by chaotic dynamical system.
And if you use, huge amount of points, so such math cannot land at all. I'll give you play game with this a little bit, back to dynamics. And my suspicion a little bit in this direction is that it's probable that in temporal context, in this special case, so there is something that these neurons you mentioned as part of a tractor in your case, you learn something from dynamics design of these tractors.
Anything else? Yeah.
I have a question. Is it true that some quiet this experiment that this delayed activity is appears after you and after you give a task? So, remember this stimulus. Whereas, does it imply that if you don't say it, there will be no delayed activity?
No. So the whole thing, at least in infratemporal cortex, the one point that I am sure of is that you see this delay activity irrespective of the behavioral significance of the stimulus. Why is that? Because we've seen that there's delay activity also across intertrial intervals. So the monkey sees a sample stimulus, then there's a test stimulus, and he has to respond. Is it the same or different? And then after the test stimulus, if say that the test stimulus is the appropriate stimulus, say the umbrella, you see delay activity across the interval where the monkey doesn't have to remember what the stimulus is, okay? So...
Before the monkey had to remember this particular...
Yeah.
Can you pick a cell that is almost equally responsive to two different stimuli? And then you record from the cell and you, for one stimulus, they remember it. And then at the test stimuli, if another one which is different from the first one, but which naturally also evokes some response in the cell, would you say delayed activity after the test stimuli is the same?
So I'm not sure if I follow the point. The point is, if you use similar images, do you see similar delay activity?
No, the question is that you understand that if you use kind of optimal stimuli for the cell, right? When you ask to remember.
No, to be frank, we used a fixed set of images. But we looked at the optimal stimulus out of this fixed set.
Out of this fixed set.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you're saying that if you show the first stimulus,
yes,
delay activity, and you show the same as a test,
yeah, you still see...
You still see delay, even
right,
though there is no task to keep this in memory.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But on the other hand, there was this task. So maybe there is no distancing. Oh, I don't have to remember it now. I can forget. You asked to remember this.
Okay.
So it's not surprising that there is still the activity in response to this stimulus. What I'm saying, if I have a cell that
yes,
is out in the task with response to two stimuli.
Okay.
Different ones.
Okay.
And then you show two different ones as the one you have to remember and the test one that you don't have to remember. Would there be delayed activity in the cell?
Okay, we haven't done this, but I suspect that you're going to see, this is the prediction, that you're going to see delay activity even if you train a monkey just to do a fixation task. So he doesn't have to pay attention to the stimuli at all, okay? But you repeat, that's a prediction. You repeat the images over and over again, okay? You're going to get the generation of attractors just because the attractors are generated according to the statistics of the images, right? So you're going to get the, and you should see delay activity, although the monkey would never pay attention. He doesn't have to do anything with these images, okay? We haven't done this experiment, but that's a prediction, okay? If it's really mechanistically generated, it should happen. If it's mechanically generated, it should happen even if the monkey never actually uses these images to do anything, okay? He doesn't have to do a memory task at all.
Okay, connected question. Then we have some
interrupting images.
Yeah.
Basically, the fact that you gave a task to start with, it kind of kills the possibility of delayed activity in response to interrupting stimuli.
I'm not sure
because
I follow.
If you don't give a task and you solve something,
yes,
you say that there still can be delayed activity.
Yeah, that's a prediction from the. I'm saying that's a prediction of the tractor network approach. Yeah.
Then you give a task, you solve the first stimulus.
Right. Yeah. I'm with you.
Then you show so interrupting images.
And you still get delay activity for the first image.
Yeah, but what about the interrupting one?
Right. So that's a question. What we.
Are you giving a task?
What was it?
What about the delayed activity to interrupting stimulus?
Why is there no delay activity to the interrupting stimulus?
Did you kill it when you gave the task at the beginning? Like
right, so I think Misha referred to this. There are two options. First, it could be that the first image, for some reason, the first image is dominant. Okay, so once you are in the attractor state of that image, the other images are not strong enough to take you out of the attractor. Okay, so that's one possibility. The other could be that in prefrontal cortex, it's a different ball game than infratemporal cortex. In prefrontal cortex, it really matters what the behavioral task requires. Okay. So that you have to remember the first image, and therefore all other images are suppressed somehow. So there's a gating, of all other images. That's also possible. Yeah.
Can it be a preposition of both attractor, or which could be the prediction really? I mean that either if you are, for example, if you're there, if yourself is sensitive to a stimuli, then. Only one of them should, if you present both of them, you should only see the delay for one of those. I mean,
okay.
The delay for response to the
So now you're saying a superposition of two images. Maybe Misha could answer this. I'm not sure. If you present a superposition of two images.
Or even one after another. Or even one after another.
Yeah? One after another.
That's an interesting thing, but I understand that the results of how little.
Yeah.
And no matter what intervening stimuli are, it's just basically.
But I suspect that the reason is that it's the behavioral significance, because for all reasons, I think that prefrontal cortex is involved with just sort of keeping track of things and sort of it's. My guess would be that the reason that you see this delay activity for the first stimulus is because it's the one you have to remember. And if you were to remember the second one, you'd see delay activity for the second one. But, it's my guess. Yeah.
I'm very interested in how this experiment was done. I was wondering how you found the neuron that responded to
how did we find the neurons that responded to an image?
Yeah. You tried every neurons one by one, or you just tried one and you tried different.
Yeah. So the way we do it is the following. It's a good question. Okay. So you advance the electrode. You find you isolate a cell. You see the action potential of a cell. Okay. And now you just use the different images. So we've had 30 images, and you see the responses to the neuron to these different images. Yeah, we've had a fixed set of images that we kept using, okay? And clearly, not all cells were selective to any of these images, okay? Because it was a limited set of images. But something, I'd say on the order of half of the cells were selective to one of these images.
There may be more than one image, like five images, that the neuron...
Oh, yeah, the neurons were selective. Typically, the neurons were not just selected. That's a question that was asked before, to one of the images, but to several of the images. Okay. Now, most neurons, that's another point to mention regarding the sparseness. Most neurons may have been visually active, but did not have delay activity. It's only a fraction of the neurons, something like 10% of the neurons, which had this delay activity. Okay. Again, in prefrontal cortex, the numbers are slightly higher. They're about 30%, but it's a conceivable sort of... That may well be. Yeah. Right.
What happens if you use images which are technically talking already, like photographs of bananas and trees and so on?
So you're saying.
Images like that images would
Okay, so there's a claim that if the monkeys are, if it's not clear, but there's a claim in the literature that if the monkeys are have to learn to sort of discriminate between specific types of images, the percentage of cells which fire to these images, which are sort of the ones which are familiar, is bigger than to novel images. Okay, so there's some plasticity in that respect as well. That's the claim. Okay, it's not quite clear cut, but that's the claim. Yeah. How you start? What is the starting point? The starting point is that the connections are randomly, they're random, okay, in terms of their strength as well, okay? They're random, but they're strengthened because of the Hebbian learning, first of all, between groups of neurons which respond to the same image, okay? So what was implicit in the model was that the neurons were selective to specific images. In each group of neurons was selective to one image, just for simplicity. And of course, that's not the case. They're selective to more than one image, but that was done for simplicity sake. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
How does the system actually decide that the image was the same? I mean, that basically. That means that in effect the attractor will.
Good question.
It will go into the same attractor again? And
no, great question. Great question.
Doesn't mean that in between for another image, it did not go into the image's attractor?
You're absolutely right. That in a sense, all you have is that, okay, you've given an image during the sample stimulus, and you've gone to a specific attractor. Now say that you present the same image again, you go to the same attractor state. Well, but still, how you have to retain somehow in which attractor you've been during the sample stimulus in order to perform the task, right? So that's something that is not clear, at least to me. Huh?
In the model, people study it. For example, if you have to go to the same attractor, it can be faster than going to another one. So it could just be better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why would it go to...
The network is in the right attractor and then you come to the same stimulus.
Okay. Okay.
And then how would you do that with the repeated?
That's for him. That's for him. I would.
With several images in between, how would that work then?
Yeah.
That would have to return, or I mean, it seems to me that there has to be some other state involved because the attractor can basically only have one state and maybe be stronger in this state or not so strong.
Good point.
If the attractor really recognizes the other images in between, then it has to go in that state. That's how we define recognize. And there has to be some other state that pulls back the.
Right.
I can't see how this can work without the
one. I think it's right.
I can only see it works if the first attractor stays stable, survives. If you are really going every time to a new attractor, then.
Right.
So I mean, it could not recognize the immediate
images on the level. Right. There's no information left before about
it. No, but the claim is that the neurons in IT would recognize the images, the intermediate images, right? At least the last image, okay? Because they go. Are you with me? I mean, the idea is that if you look at the neurons in prefrontal cortex. They retain the attractor state of the first image, the sample image. But if you look at the neurons in IT, they retain the last image seen. Okay, so if it's an intervening stimulus, you're going to have a representation of the last intervening stimulus. Okay?
Right.
So you have...
Second state.
Where is the logical operation performed saying this image is equal to the other image or another image?
Oh, okay, I think that's unclear. Okay, let's put it this way. If you look at the neurons in prefrontal cortex, what you find is that they respond differently during the presentation of the test stimulus, depending if it's a match or a non-match. Okay? There's an enhanced firing. Okay, so let me go through this just to make. Okay, so say you've presented the first image was an umbrella, and then you present, yeah, something like this and this, and finally there's an umbrella again. Okay, if you look at so this is a sample, and these are a non-match. Non-match, finally a match, okay? If you look at the activity for the matching stimulus, typically in prefrontal cortex, what you'd find is that it's higher than the activity for the sample stimulus, okay? So at least this is a, it's not clear how the computation has actually been carried out, but the outcome is clear. You get a differential response, okay, which is different if it's a matched stimulus versus if it's a non-matched stimulus. Okay. Okay. I think we'll end it here. Thank you very much.